The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
The impeachment trial of President Trump continues today. A central question, will John Bolton testify? Democrats say he must.
Think about the precedent you will be setting if you don't allow witnesses in a trial.
Also, China put millions of people under lockdown in Wuhan to try and halt the spread of the coronavirus. But infectious disease experts just don't know how well it will work.
What's happening in Wuhan is the largest public health experiment ever done by humankind.
Looking for a new activity this winter? Dr. Ice is taking his swimsuit to the waters of Antarctica.
When I first started, I was obviously deemed a bit insane. It was such a new thing and people thought there was something wrong with me.
To clarify, he's not packing a wetsuit. I'm Carol Hills. Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Planes filled with Americans, Europeans, and Japanese are flying out of Wuhan. That's a Chinese provincial capital that's the epicenter of the coronavirus outbreak. Many of those passengers will be placed in quarantine for 2 weeks. And inside China, some 56 million citizens are in lockdown. A growing list of airlines are also scaling back flights to China. British Airways has canceled all flights. But are these flight suspensions, quarantines, and evacuations effective ways to combat the outbreak? Dr. William Schaffner has some expertise on the issue. He's an infectious disease expert at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. Dr. Schaffner, when you hear about these evacuations and quarantines and flight suspensions, what's your immediate reaction? I mean, do you think on the whole these are good moves or not?
They're not perfect moves. We can't expect perfection, but reducing traffic, that is person traffic, between China and the rest of the world clearly is a measure of containment of spread, because the spread is done by human beings who travel from one place to another, taking the virus with them.
But are some of the moves motivated by fear and maybe kind of impulsive?
Fear is always involved. I don't think they're impulsive. This is clearly a serious virus, and we would like to interdict the spread of this virus so that it doesn't run around the world creating the coronavirus pandemic.
I want to focus for a moment on the quarantines for those being flown out of China. In the UK, some of those returning are likely to be quarantined at a military facility. Australia plans to send its 600 returning citizens to Christmas Island for 2 weeks. That's over 1,000 miles from the Australian mainland, and they're going to be housed in a former immigrant detention camp. I mean, do these sorts of measures make sense from a scientific perspective?
The science behind that sort of quarantine is, shall we say, modest. It makes good conceptual sense, but it's never been really well demonstrated that these sorts of quarantines work very effectively. There are always ways around the quarantine, perhaps not on Christmas Island and perhaps not in a supervised facility, but when you try to quarantine communities, there are always people who find their way out.
What about the lockdowns around Wuhan? Those affect millions of people. Do those make sense, or do they make it harder to actually treat people?
Well, what's happening in Wuhan is the largest public health experiment ever done by humankind. It'll be difficult to assess exactly how successful that was in limiting the spread within China. The logistical things become very difficult. How do you get food in? How do you get medicines in? And within the city of Wuhan, there's difficulty in accessing medical care. Are enough medical supplies coming in? Are there sufficient medical personnel that are being brought in? The logistical aspects of any sort of quarantine are always very challenging.
What are you kind of looking for next? What kind of worries you, or what are you encouraged by when you look at the situation, which is extremely fluid?
The most encouraging news I've heard today is that the Chinese authorities have accepted the invitation of both the World Health Organization and our CDC to send in people who can assist the Chinese. You know, the folks at the CDC, they have written the book on being disease detectives and setting up studies that can help not only limit the spread of the disease, but analyze its characteristics so we can define what's actually going on.
Is there something that's unprecedented about this particular outbreak?
This outbreak actually resembles the appearance of a new strain of influenza. And that's why I have hope that the development of vaccines that can be manufactured quickly could be deployed to, in several months, abort further spread of this infection.
And people are working on a vaccine as we speak, aren't they?
People are working around the world on developing this vaccine, and that was a consequence of the Chinese scientists sequencing the genome of this new virus so promptly and then putting that information out so the world scientific community can use it. The first great triumph was creating a rapid diagnostic test that's now being employed around the world. The next hope is, of course, a vaccine, and a third line of research is into developing antiviral therapies so that if you got sick, we would have a medication that would reduce the severity and shorten the illness.
William Schaffner is an infectious disease expert at Vanderbilt University. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
There's a lot to learn about this new virus. Even the name is new to a lot of us, coronavirus. So what should we be calling this thing? Here's the world's Alana Gordon with an explainer.
In China, the virus is commonly known for the city where the outbreak was first reported.
People refer to the virus as Wuhan Fei Yan, which is Wuhan pneumonia.
That's Jiang Yinfeng from the BBC's Chinese service. The term Wu flu has also taken off on social media. The scientific community has a different name for the virus, a more technical one. Stanley Perlman is a researcher at the University of Iowa who's studying the virus.
So I just actually wrote an editorial for a journal, and I called it 2019-nCoV because that's what the manuscript that I was looking at called it.
He says this scientific abbreviation stands for 2019 Novel Coronavirus. Coronavirus is a term we've been hearing a lot. It doesn't come from the beer. The name reflects what the virus looks like under a microscope.
You can see a corona that's either the corona of the sun or the corona of a crown.
There's other coronaviruses like SARS and MERS. So what to formally call this one? Perlman says this might seem simple, but it's not. Reaching an agreement on a name for a new infectious disease in humans can be tricky and even contentious.
And it's really been interesting to me to balancing all these things of how to get a name right so it's accurate and it tells you how it's related to other viruses and make sure that doesn't put any negative connotations on people.
Scientists and health officials are wrestling with this now. Perlman says he and other coronavirus experts went back and forth all day last Thursday over what to recommend calling this new virus. There's no formal process to naming a virus, a bacteria, or a disease, but it has evolved over time. Dr. Howard Markell is a historian at the University of Michigan. He says, traditionally, it's been the scientists who first discover a new pathogen who get first dibs on naming it.
That was the big thing in the 19th century, to have things, diseases, and so on named after you. That was a sign of success in medicine.
Take the bacteria for plague. It's called
Yersinia pestis.
That comes from the guy who discovered it in 1894.
Alexandre Yersin.
Moving along, the Ebola virus was named after the Ebola River near the African village where it was first discovered in 1976. But naming an infectious virus after a person or place can be problematic. Here's Stanley Perlman again.
The people who live there are unfairly being associated with a virus, and they don't want to be, and it's really not their fault.
That is why the World Health Organization now warns against naming diseases after a specific person, place, or thing. The WHO issued guidelines in 2015 on this to minimize the negative impact on trade, travel, places, and people. One cautionary tale happened 10 years ago. The H1N1 virus was known around the world as swine flu. Again, Markell, our medical historian.
Which was a misnomer back in 2009. It really wasn't caused by pigs or anything like that, but everyone called it that.
Still, the pork industry took a hit, reporting a drop in sales. Another cautionary example is the early days of HIV and AIDS. Early on, the virus was called gay-related immune deficiency, or GRID, or sometimes gay cancer.
So that would have been a bad name. And, you know, there's enough problems with people being scapegoated for contagious diseases. People who are disenfranchised or are so-called undesirable groups. There's a long, long history of those people being blamed for the importation of that disease.
The WHO has taken extra steps. It outlined a list of do's and don'ts when it comes to naming a disease. Do make it short and easy to pronounce, like malaria or polio. Also include accurate and descriptive terms like respiratory or neurologic or juvenile. Perlman says in the end, a virus or a disease may actually have a couple agreed-on names, one that's more technical, that the scientific community uses, and another one that's common with the public.
Clearly, the goal is to have something that's probably in reality most useful for the scientific community, but then also can be referred to in a way that's useful for the general public. So, you know, influenza has these long names, but people call it the flu, and we all understand that.
The WHO may decide to take a more active role in naming new contagious diseases, especially if popular names are, quote, inappropriate. Markell and others say that might be a good idea now, given how much the term Wuhan pneumonia is spreading around the internet. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
The impeachment trial of President Trump entered a new phase today.
I send a question to the desk.
I send a question to the desk.
I send a question to the desk.
Senators now have 2 days to submit their questions in writing to be read aloud by Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts, who's presiding over the trial. And then either the Democratic impeachment managers or the president's defense lawyers have 5 minutes to answer. The questions today covered a range of topics, but by far the million-dollar question, the one looming over the next few days of proceedings, is this one, as read by the Chief Justice.
Is there any way for the Senate to render a fully informed verdict in this case without hearing the testimony of Bolton, Mulvaney, and the other key eyewitnesses, or without seeing the relevant documentary evidence?
Democrat Adam Schiff's answer was unsurprising.
The short answer to that question is no.
The key witness that Democrats are asking for is John Bolton. In his new manuscript leaked to the New York Times, he alleges to have direct firsthand knowledge of the president asking for the withholding of military aid to Ukraine in exchange for political favors. But today, the president's defense lawyer, Pat Philbin, made the case that calling Bolton as a witness would set a bad precedent. Because it isn't the job of the Senate to call witnesses in impeachment hearings, he said that's the job of the House.
To insist now that this body will become the investigative body, that this body will have to do all the discovery, and that this institution will be effectively paralyzed for months on end. That should not be the precedent that is set here for the way this body will have to handle all impeachments in the future, because if it becomes that easy for the House to do it, they'll be doing it a lot.
Another issue that came up today, was there any quid pro quo? Did the president withhold military aid in exchange for something that would benefit him? One of the president's lawyers, Alan Dershowitz, said in this instance, it doesn't matter.
Every public official that I know believes that his election is in the public interest. And mostly you're right. Your election is in the public interest. And if a president does something which he believes will help him get elected in the public interest, that cannot be the kind of quid pro quo that results in impeachment.
Adam Schiff took argument with this. He said if that's the defense,
then the next president of the United States can ask for an investigation of you. They can ask for help in their next election from any foreign power. And the argument will be made, nope, Donald Trump was acquitted for doing exactly the same thing. Therefore, it must not be impeachable.
Senators will get another full day to ask questions. Democrats will need at least 4 Republicans to join their ranks to compel new witnesses to be called to testify. That vote is expected on Friday. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. An update for you on Australia's historic bushfires. Record-breaking temperatures and months of severe drought are fueling a series of massive fires across Australia. Rainfall over the past few weeks have helped, but 60 fires are still raging across southeastern Australia. So far, 30 people have died this fire season, and enough land to fill the state of Indiana has burned. Meanwhile, across the Indian Ocean from Australia and thousands of miles away, another natural disaster has been unfolding. Catastrophic floods have devastated East Africa, including Kenya, Ethiopia, South Sudan, and Somalia.
At least 50 people are dead in this area alone.
The severe flooding swept through western Kenya.
Rain and flash flooding has killed hundreds of people in several countries in East Africa.
Flash floods and landslides have killed at least 250 people in the last few months and affected millions more. This abnormally bad year for both flooding and fires is not a coincidence. These two phenomena are actually linked. The world's Anna Kusmer explains what connects the two.
It's a weather phenomenon known as the Indian Ocean Dipole. It's also known as the southern cousin of El Nino. You can picture a map. Imagine Australia is on the lower right-hand side. A little bit higher up to the west is Africa. And in between them is the vast body of water, the Indian Ocean.
So what's going on?
Surface waters are being pushed by winds away from Australia towards Africa. And those temperature shifts are wreaking havoc on the weather in both places. I talked to an ocean researcher named Wenju Chai, who's based in Australia. He says the ocean is extremely powerful and it's controlling this weather.
Ocean control the weather, where the rain is. And that's why these two, flooding and fire and drought, are actually part of the same phenomenon.
So it sounds like the issue is more warm water toward the west, toward Africa, more cold water to the east, toward Australia, and that's having an impact on the level of floods and fires?
Exactly. So warmer water means more water being sucked up by clouds and dumped on the land next door. So eastern Africa is getting more warm water, which means they're getting more rain. And in Australia to the east, it's the exact opposite. Cold water means less evaporation, and essentially Africa is getting Australia's rain. In 2019 saw one of the biggest dipoles ever recorded by scientists.
So, of course, my next question, and you know what it is, whenever we hear about extreme weather, we think climate change. Is it connected to climate change?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So while we can't say, yes, this extreme dipole is a direct result of climate change, Wenju Chai, the scientist, he runs models of how different climate change scenarios impact the Indian Ocean dipole. And he found that dipoles like this year's will get more frequent if emissions continue at their current rate.
But in the next 100 years, under the business as usual scenarios, those extreme dipole events occurs three times as often, from once per 18 years to one in 6 years.
But if we do something about climate change, meaning lowering the amount of emissions that are contributing to climate change, could this trend be reversible?
Yeah, Wenju Chai looked at what would happen to the dipole if the world is able to meet Paris Agreement goals. That means limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2 degrees Celsius. And he found that under that scenario, extreme dipole events get far less frequent.
So the dipole is actually related to a number of things we've been covering on the program.
Yeah, Carol, it kind of is this perfect example of how the ocean is such a powerful force in our world and how many things it affects. Another thing that we've been reporting on here has been horrible locust outbreaks in the Horn of Africa. Increased rainfall in eastern Africa is partly driving those locust outbreaks as well, which have been devastating for farmers and herders. So really, all these things that we're talking about are deeply connected.
The world's Anna Kusmer. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Carol.
If sport is about pushing human limits, this next story takes us pretty close to the edge. The world's Bianca Hillier ventures into the freezing cold world of ice swimming.
Here we go.
Ice swimming is just what it sounds like.
Ice swimming is anything below 5 degrees.
Jer Kennedy is a world-renowned ice swimmer. 5 degrees Celsius is 41 degrees Fahrenheit. For context, the ocean temperature outside of Boston today is just above that. One other thing about ice swimming: no wetsuits allowed. Just a swimming cap, goggles, earplugs, and a regular old swimsuit. Kennedy says it's not that they enjoy the cold.
No, not really, no. The level we go to now is extremely painful.
Kennedy's nickname is Dr. Ice. Next month, he leaves his home country of Ireland and heads to Antarctica. His goal is to complete an ice swim on every continent.
My plan, and again, it's only a plan, it's not guaranteed, is to swim a 1 mile distance inside the Antarctic Circle.
That's really dangerous. Even in perfect conditions, swimming in water that cold could cause respiratory issues, even hypothermia. So ice swimmers like Kennedy train for months. They slowly train to get used to colder and colder water.
When I first started, I was obviously deemed a bit insane, you know. It was such a new thing and people thought there was something wrong with me. As we started to achieve and the ice swim community started to build in Ireland, criticism got lower and then realized we're very dialed in people.
Being that dialed in could have health benefits too. Research shows cold water can ward off illness and even help with depression and anxiety. There's an international ice swimming association with athletes in 78 countries. Right now, it's busy season in Antarctica.
I'm speaking to you from inside my tent deep in East Antarctica.
That's Lewis Pugh of England, speaking to me from one of the most remote places on Earth. Pugh went to Antarctica last week to attempt to become the first person to swim under an Antarctic ice sheet. Yeah, under a sheet of ice. He and his team planned every stroke of the swim.
If I swim from here, yeah, and then around this corner here, keep well clear of those stalactites.
I checked in with Pugh after his swim.
The swim was certainly one of the toughest swims of my life and certainly the most dangerous.
A 10-minute swim in 32-degree water in just a Speedo. If you're like me, you'll have to see it to believe it. The photos are on our Instagram page. We're at PRI The World.
Merci.
Welcome on board.
Thank you.
Pugh's real mission goes beyond the swim itself. He wants to focus attention on climate change. Pugh is aware that traveling to a place like Antarctica is energy intensive, but the global problem becomes very clear here. He says the place is melting.
We now need to take serious, decisive action before it's too late, because the time for talking has now run out.
Call it Speedo diplomacy. Pugh says it's something worth risking his life for.
By far the most frightening part of this whole swim was about halfway when I heard this almighty boom above my head. And I looked up and I thought, oh no, please no. I thought an enormous piece of ice was going to come crashing down. Luckily it didn't. It was just the glacier above me moving. Anyway, I've never ever swum so fast for the last 3 minutes of that swim until I finally got to the end and my team pulled me out. I was absolutely frozen, right down to the marrow in my bones.
Next stop for Pugh is the relative warmth of Moscow. In a tweet today, he said he's still thawing out. Let's kick it. Ice, baby. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
A Harvard chemistry professor was hauled off by federal authorities. The charge? Lying about working with China.
China is engaged in a massive, long-term campaign to steal U.S. research and technology for its own uses.
The perils American scientists can face by moonlighting for Beijing. That's coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, and PRX. In the race to build out the fastest wireless networks, there's also politics to consider. I'm talking about the UK's decision this week to allow the Chinese company Huawei a limited role in developing its 5G networks. Here's British Prime Minister Boris Johnson.
I think it is absolutely vital that people in this country do have access to the best technology available, but that we also do absolutely nothing to imperil our relationship with the United States.
President Trump has lobbied aggressively against Huawei's global expansion. The administration is worried that the equipment could be used by Beijing for spying. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo traveled to London today to urge UK officials to reconsider their decision. Joining me now is Peter Ricketts, the UK's former national security advisor. Peter, it seems to boil down to this. The US thinks Huawei equipment poses a spying risk. Huawei denies this. And the UK is somewhere in the middle. What does Britain gain from allowing Huawei limited access to its 5G networks?
Well, the problem that Britain confronts and other countries is that our politicians have promised a fast and safe and secure broadband to the population. It was one of their election pledges. But when our experts look at the market and the available equipment, there is no American 5G solution or a British one. There are a couple of European companies, Ericsson and Nokia, but they also use Chinese components. And there is Huawei, which, as I understand, is cheaper and more advanced than anything else on the market. So to deliver their promise to the electors, they have to put together a sort of mix of the different products available. And having looked at it all very carefully, the experts have assured our ministers that there are ways of having that sort of diversified mix, keeping Huawei equipment well out of anything sensitive or anything to do with actually transforming the data into encryption, which works.
So it's partly an issue of necessity, but do you think the fact that the UK thinks Huawei is okay in terms of being involved with its 5G network and the US doesn't, do you think US intelligence or the Trump administration is getting this wrong?
Hang on just a sec. We don't think Huawei is okay. I think nobody here has got any illusions about the Chinese state and its reputation for spying, or that Huawei, you know, is under the influence of the Chinese state. So we do this with our eyes open. But we believe that there are ways in which its equipment can be there in what they call the periphery or the edge of this new 5G network. Bear in mind that we already have it in our 3G network, on our 4G network, as I believe does the US. So this is not a complete sort of black and white change. It's an incremental addition. And the government have said very clearly in their decision yesterday that as and when, you know, better, more secure equipment is available from America or anyone else, then, you know, that will be built into the system as it develops. So it's a dynamic situation. But if you want my honest opinion, I'm not sure that the American and the British national security worlds differ very much on this. I think what we've been getting is the America-China competition about who's going to dominate in the next generation of high tech, whether it's in artificial intelligence or 5G. And our relatively technical issue has got caught up in this wider US-China competition. And it's been very uncomfortable for us because we don't like to be in a different place from our American allies.
Now, I've got to pull in Brexit, of course. And I guess I'm wondering, with the UK leaving the European Union this Friday, does that create any incentive for the UK to move closer to Chinese markets? I mean, that's political in a way, too.
I think it leads us into a new world where we won't be part of this EU collective. We'll be out on our own account. And it's a pretty uncomfortable, difficult world where we'll have lots of difficult choices to make. So our foreign policy, I'm afraid, is going to be a series of rather awkward choices. Huawei has shown, at least it has shown, and I think it's a good thing, that this government is capable of taking a difficult decision where the arguments were finally balanced and there was a lot of passion on both sides, but they have taken a clear decision. It is also quite interesting to see that President Trump has been very quiet on this. We haven't had an intervention from the president. Mr. Pompeo has suggested that we should reconsider. I'm sure we would reconsider if America could offer, you know, a cutting-edge 5G solution that we could put into our networks. But for the moment, we don't see that. This is a pragmatic solution to the problem and is not an absolutely dramatic black-and-white change from the past.
Peter Ricketts is the UK's former national security advisor. Peter, thanks a lot for your time.
Pleasure.
Harvard professor cuffed in federal court. It isn't a headline you see every day, but that's what happened yesterday to Charles Lieber, the head of Harvard's chemistry department. He was arrested for lying about his ties to China, including accepting over $1 million in research funding from the Chinese government. U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling unveiled the charges yesterday.
Through the use of not only traditional intelligence officers, but academics, researchers, its own private citizens, China is engaged in a massive, long-term campaign to steal U.S. research and technology for its own uses.
Kirk Carapeza has been following this story. He covers higher education with our partners here at WGBH News in Boston.
Federal prosecutors say Lieber lied about his work with this Chinese program that recruits high-level talent. Prosecutors say that program engages in espionage. Now, in federal court, Lieber was charged with misrepresenting his Chinese ties to the Department of Defense and the National Institutes of Health. Court documents claim Lieber was earning as much as $50,000 a month from a Chinese university.
And so part of what Charles Lieber was doing was he was involved in this Chinese program, the Thousand Talents Program.
Right. And prosecutors say this program is designed to recruit and cultivate high-level scientific talent and to further China's scientific development, economic prosperity, national security, and to steal intellectual property.
Is there any evidence that what Charles Lieber did was some sort of espionage?
No, he's not being charged with espionage. The one count is clear. He's being charged with misleading or lying to federal authorities.
Lieber's case is being grouped with two other cases in Boston involving American scientific research in China. What are those cases about?
So prosecutors say a Harvard-affiliated researcher was caught with 21 vials of cells stolen from a lab at Beth Israel Hospital here in Boston, and that the researcher planned to publish his research in China under his own name. And a former student at Boston University is accused of lying to authorities about her status as a lieutenant in the People's Liberation Army.
What are the politics of this? I mean, the Trump administration has been kind of going after China for years on trade issues and all sorts of stuff around intellectual property. Is your sense this is a political thing, or is there a there?
There's genuine concern. Following the arrest, Democratic U.S. Representative Seth Moulton said he'd introduce legislation designed to help detect foreign agents. So you have people on both sides of the aisle reacting to this. Lelling, we should point out, was appointed by President Trump. But I think it does play into the politics of higher education. I mean, the American higher education has taken a beating over the past few years. A 2017 Pew Research Center study found that for the first time, a majority of Republicans in the U.S. think that colleges have a negative effect on the future of this country. And I just came back from a reporting trip in rural Tennessee, and I found there's a real sense there that they, the coastal elites, academics, are undermining their values, are undermining the mission of the country. And cases like this play into those politics. People see this and they say, see, it confirms my belief that American higher education, that colleges are not making the country a better place. So it's a tough time for higher ed, and the politics of these cases, I don't think, help.
But in the general issue of intellectual property theft and these technology battles and competition between the U.S. and China, is it a serious concern? Is it a real concern that American scientists and technologists and academics are in some ways helping China?
I think it depends who you ask. If you ask certain politicians and certain prosecutors would say yes, but academics, I think we're already worried about a chilling effect. In many ways, the scientific community is suspecting that these investigators are racially profiling students and faculty. Lieber is white, which is interesting, and he's the first non-Chinese scientist to be charged in what some are calling a new Red Scare on campus. And many schools here in Boston, in the Boston area, say their international students are experiencing new delays in visa processing, which we've covered here on the show. Bill Kirby teaches China studies at Harvard Business School, and he says even established scholars are experiencing delays in their visas.
I've seen it in practice. Highly reputable Chinese academics having difficulty getting what would ordinarily be routine visas to come to the United States being slow-walked.
So where's Charles Lieber now?
A federal judge denied him bail, so he's under U.S. custody here in Boston, and Harvard has placed him on paid administrative leave, and his next court hearing is set for tomorrow here in Boston.
Kirk Carapeza covers higher education for WGBH News here in Boston. Thanks a lot, Kirk.
Thanks, Carol.
Who owns the Nile? Leaders from Egypt, Ethiopia, and Sudan are meeting today in Washington to sort that out. They're trying to hammer out an agreement on a decades-long dispute over a multi-billion-dollar dam project in Ethiopia. It's become a point of pride for Ethiopians, but its downstream neighbors are worried. The World's Halima Gikandi has our story.
When we think about the Nile River, we really think about one country first, Egypt. Kalthoum is one of Egypt's most famous singers, here with an ode to the Nile River. Egypt itself was called the Gift of the Nile by the ancient Greek historian Herodotus. The fact is, there are two Niles. One begins in the lakes of East Africa, the other in the highlands of Eritrea and Ethiopia. They converge in Sudan, flow downstream into Egypt and into the Mediterranean. Millions of people rely on the Nile River for their livelihoods, especially in Egypt, which struggles with water scarcity and drought. At least 85% of the country's freshwater supply comes from the Nile. So when Ethiopia decided to build a $4 billion hydroelectric dam, its downstream neighbors were concerned, to say the least. Said Sadak is a professor of political sociology at Nile University in Egypt.
I mean, Egypt is basically the gift of the Nile. So when the Ethiopians began to expand the structure of the dam, beyond the earlier expectation. That caused a lot of political tensions between Egypt and Ethiopia.
The Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam is also known as GERD. For Ethiopia, it's a dream years in the making. In the 1960s, the United States funded a multi-million dollar survey of the Nile to explore its economic potential for Ethiopia. But Ethiopia doesn't need the dam for water. It needs it for electricity. Nearly 60% of the population does not have access to it. Shemeles Desu is a water resources engineer who studies the Nile.
Electricity is being rationed. People get electricity in specific days of the week, 2, 3, or maybe 4 days a week, even the ones connected to the grid system. So that's how critical power is for Ethiopia.
Ethiopia began constructing the dam in 2011. Today, it's mostly completed. Once fully operational, the GERD will have the capacity to generate 6,000 megawatts of hydropower. That's a game changer for Ethiopia.
Blue Nile is right at the center of where the demand is in terms of electricity. And by constructing the dam at the border, Ethiopia looks into the potential of getting the benefit by selling electricity to Sudan and possibly Egypt.
But some Egyptians see the GERD as an existential threat. The country fears that the new dam will give Ethiopia too much control over the flow of water in the Nile. Egypt is a country of more than 100 million people. Most of that population lives on just 6% of the country's land. The rest is desert. Sadiq says Egypt's concerns are real.
For Egyptians, this is life or death. No water. We are already suffering from shortage of water.
It's not just Egypt that's concerned. Sudan sits between Egypt and Ethiopia. Mohamed Bashir is a Sudanese engineer at the University of Manchester in England. He says the dam could hurt farmers in Sudan who schedule their crops around flood seasons.
These people will basically lose their livelihoods. So one of my arguments now in my research is that Sudan should have some adaptation time to find alternatives for this population.
The three countries have engaged in on-and-off negotiations for years, but they have failed to reach a compromise. Some of the disagreements are about technical issues. If Ethiopia fills the dam too quickly, it could disrupt the flow of water to Egypt. But the longer Ethiopia takes to fill the dam, the longer it would take to reap the benefits of hydropower. In October, the United States stepped in as a mediator. Bashir says if they can reach a compromise, the dam could benefit all three countries.
When the GERD is built in the upstream, the GERD will have the same role of the High Aswan Dam. So it will regulate the flow to Sudan and will enable Sudan to use water almost all over the year and increase hydropower generation.
For engineers like Bashir and Desu, the dispute over the dam underscores an urgent reality. The Nile River is a limited but vital resource shared by 11 different countries. Their populations are growing and ambitions are competing. But the dam project is also an opportunity to set a precedent on how to share the gifts of the Nile. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. As the bushfires continue to burn in Australia, people there have found distraction in one of the world's biggest tennis tournaments, the Australian Open. In particular, Australians are rallying behind their local hero, Ashley Barty.
Wouldn't want it to end that way, but it's Barty who comes through with an Australia Day victory.
That's Barty winning her match on Sunday. Tonight, East Coast time, she'll take on American Sophia Kenin in the semifinals. The BBC's John Watson has been looking into why so many Australians want to party with Ashley Barty.
She seems a very cool, calm, collected character. How special is she to this country?
Pretty special. We haven't really had anyone at world number one for a long time, and she finally did it.
And the big question is now, how far can she go? What are you guys hoping that she can achieve this year?
All the way.
You were cheering hard during the match then.
Yeah, she's going to go all the way.
Listen, you save your voice, okay? Do you honestly think, though, that she could win it this year?
Oh, of course, yeah. Take out all four, I say.
But we just do wonder, don't we? What has been behind this remarkable rise? Well, I've been putting that exact question to Jackie Felgate, a reporter from Channel 7.
I think Australians have really gotten behind her because it has been such a long time since we've had a number one. She plays the game so beautifully. It's such a classic game that she plays, and she's so amazing to watch. We just spoke to her then. She's such a kind person when you talk to her. Everything she says, she really thinks about it, and she's just a great ambassador for Australian tennis.
She seems very relaxed, and obviously there's going to be a huge amount of support here for her, but how much expectation is riding on her shoulders at the moment?
I think so much. And the fact that Australians, they're looking for that hero, they're looking for that person to take tennis to the next level for us. And having her win the French and then to not go all the way at Wimbledon, obviously we've been really looking forward for her home Grand Slam, for her to do really well here.
We know there's been so much going on in the country at the moment with the bushfires and obviously the smoke, and it would mean a huge amount in light of all of that were an Australian to win either the men's or the women's singles this year. But Ash Barty, she's been quite matter-of-fact about it.
That's exactly right. She said that, you know, tennis is a game, and the bushfires, they've been life-changing and deadly for so many people across the country. Their livelihoods destroyed, their lives destroyed. And she really puts it all in perspective when she says things like that. She says at the end of the day, tennis is for fun, and that it doesn't matter if an Australian actually wins the Australian Open. I'm sure many Australians would disagree
but she says
with that.
It would be hugely significant,
oh,
wouldn't
absolutely.
It? And that must be coming into her thinking.
I think she's just so humble. Even the fact that she is the face of this year's Australian Open, and she says, well, I'm sick of seeing my face on these billboards. We're not sick of it at all.
Yeah. So there we go. And really interesting light of everything that the country's obviously gone through with the bushfires and the huge relief effort. It would be really special and hugely significant if she could add to that solitary Grand Slam title that she has. And if she does do it, I imagine a huge cheer. What will it be like?
The BBC's John Watson there at the Australian Open with some pretty fired up fans. And now for some more sobering news, back to the impeachment trial of President Trump. It's day 8, and we've entered a new phase, questions from senators. The World's Chris Wolfe is following the proceedings. Chris, what have been the highlights so far?
Well, I'd like to take a moment, Carol, first to recognize one of the underreported heroes of the impeachment for anyone following the trial like me day by day, and that's the Senate chaplain, Barry Black. Every day he opens proceedings with a reminder to the senators of their sacred duty. Here's an excerpt from today.
Lord, empower them to labor today with the dominant purpose of pleasing you, knowing that it is never wrong to do right.
It's just so refreshing to have this daily moment of solemnity, which must surely touch the conscience of all those who are listening.
But let's get down to it. What's exactly happening today?
Well, senators are asking questions to the lawyers for both sides to test their arguments and get clarification on specific points. They have to write the questions on small beige-coloured printed pieces of card, a little smaller than a postcard. It's like high school debate club from the 1980s. And these cards are then handed to the Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts, presiding over the trial, who then literally reads them out. Here's an example of what it sounds like.
This is a question for the counsel for the president. If President Trump had more than one motive for his alleged conduct, such as the pursuit of personal political advantage, rooting out corruption...
You get the idea. So there's 8 hours of this today, unless they run out of questions, and then there'll be another day of this tomorrow, again, assuming they have more questions.
So what have we heard of substance today?
Well, we're hearing a lot of the phrase, even if, from the president's counsel. They've moved to a stage where their efforts no longer really centered on disputing the events of the case, but asserting that even if it happened the way that the Democrats allege, it does not arise to the level of impeachment. Or a new argument we heard today from Alan Dershowitz that it could even be in the public interest. The other key issue today, of course, is whether to call witnesses. Here's Democratic House Manager Adam Schiff.
There's no way to have a fair trial without witnesses. And when you have a witness who is as plainly relevant as John Bolton, who goes to the heart of the most serious and egregious of the president's misconduct, who has volunteered to come and testify to turn him away, to look the other way, I think is deeply at odds with being an impartial juror.
So John Bolton, of course, is the president's former national security advisor. And in his forthcoming book, he alleges the president told him personally the aid to Ukraine was being held up to force them to investigate the Bidens.
So what was the response to Schiff's comment?
Well, it drew an immediate question, which showed that there would indeed be a back and forth of a kind in these question sessions. And it drew a rare laugh from the assembly.
To the president's counsel, would you please respond to the arguments or assertions the House managers just made in response to the previous question?
That's about as much fun as you get in the impeachment hearing. Presidential counsel Patrick Philbin answered the question by saying it's not the Senate's job to be the investigative body in an impeachment.
For this institution, the real question is, what is the precedent that is going to be set for what is an acceptable way for the House of Representatives to bring an impeachment of a president of the United States to this chamber? And can it be done in a hurried, half-baked, partisan fashion without, they didn't even subpoena John Bolton below. They didn't even try to get his testimony.
Of course, that's not absolutely true. They didn't subpoena him, but they did ask him to come testify, both him, John Bolton, and his deputy, at the hearings last month, and they refused.
And of course, the big question, will there be witnesses?
Well, the Senate is likely to vote on that on Friday. It's still very much, though, up in the air. The Democrats will need to be unanimous and gain the votes of four Republicans for that to happen.
The World's Chris Wolfe, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Carol.
And from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. More impeachment coverage tomorrow, along with news from around the globe.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.